The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. We'll take one more look back at the Salt Lake City Conference on Methamphetamine, HIV, and hepatitis. Methamphetamine can be a horrible master. It can debilitate your body, it can weaken your soul, and cripple your mind in much the same way that alcohol does.
I want to go ahead and introduce Don McVinney, who is the National Director of Education and Training for the Harm Reduction Training Institute. He's going to do a presentation for you on the pharmacology of methamphetamine.
A crystal methamphetamine is known by different street names. It's been called crystal, Tina, speed, crank, ice, or meth, and it depends on which region of the country you're in. It's classified as a major central nervous system stimulant. It's an amphetamine analog. Other stimulants that have been actually mentioned earlier, cocaine, caffeine, nicotine, methylphenidate, which is sold under the brand name Ritalin, which is used to treat hyperactive children, or dextroamphetamine, which is marketed as dexedrine and is used to treat depression or attention deficit disorder in adults. It's classified as a Schedule II drug, which has a high potential for abuse. Neurologically, the way crystal methamphetamine works is to release large amounts of dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter. And it causes what's been described as an energizing euphoria. It also releases lesser amounts of another neurotransmitter, serotonin, which regulates mood. And it also inhibits the reuptake of dopamine, which means you have more dopamine available in your brain. Dopamine affects a particular region of the brain that actually controls pleasure and one's experience of pleasure. And it's also involved in reward behavior. So if you do something that's pleasurable, you're more likely to continue to do it. And that leads to continued use of the substance. And while all stimulants release some dopamine, crystal methamphetamine actually releases huge quantities of dopamine. Cocaine is considered to, you know, depending on the dose, to release about 400 times more dopamine than one's normal baseline. Crystal methamphetamine releases up to perhaps 1,500 times more dopamine. There are a couple of different forms of methamphetamine. Crank or speed, sometimes referred to as biker speed on the West Coast, consists of tiny granules that have the appearance of powder, usually more of a yellowish appearance or sometimes a pinkish appearance, where crystal meth, by contrast, looks like ice or rock candy. And a bag, a quarter gram of crystal meth in San Francisco is selling for about $20. In New York City, that same quarter gram of crystal meth is between $60 and $80. There's different modes of administration, and there's harms associated with each mode of administration. Slamming crystal, which is injecting, it can be injected intravenously, skin popping, or muscle popping, and there's harms associated with each of those methods. It can also be snorted. If you snort crystal meth, you actually have to grind up the crystals into a powder. It can be swallowed in crystal-laced drinks. You can actually put crystal methamphetamine in water or coffee. And you can also create homemade pills, which many people do, which is taking crystal meth, putting it in tissue paper, and swallowing it. It can also be smoked, which is a primary mode of administration, or booty bumped, which is the rectal administration of crystal. It takes about 3 minutes if you smoke crystal before you get the full effect. If you inject, it takes between 5 to 10 minutes to get the full benefit, or swallowing it, it takes 15 to 20 minutes. And people who use crystal, what they've often said is the reason, from a harm reduction perspective, drinking the drug is probably safer than smoking it. There's actually cases of crystal-induced emphysema. There's harms associated with smoking it. There's harms associated with injecting. Swallowing it, it just takes longer to feel, even though you definitely get the effect. So why do people use crystal methamphetamine? There are a number of desirable effects. All of this is, by the way, in the literature from a number of different studies. It provides energy and increases your sense of alertness. It lessens your desire and ability to sleep. It increases sexual arousal. increases stamina and enhances endurance. It reduces your appetite. It induces this wonderful sense of self-confidence and productivity. It focuses your thinking and increases your concentration, your ability to concentrate. It also distorts perceptions of time, and it's considered to be a wonderful form of escape from the hassles of daily living. There's a huge number of perceived benefits from this drug. The desired effects that have been cited in the literature of studies among gay men additionally say that it enhances or prolongs both the intensity and the frequency of sexual encounters. It was also stated to keep you active and up for weekend-long parties. And in a number of studies, it was cited as a wonderful way of escaping from unpleasant emotions, including avoidance of dealing with one's HIV-positive status. And in another study, it was cited as a method of coping with the specter of death, which I think Patricia Case alluded to earlier. Physiological effects. When you use the drug, it increases your heart rate and your blood pressure. It increases your shallow breathing. It raises your internal body temperature. It causes sweating as a result, often profusely. It also decreases your appetite, enlarges your pupils, causes dry mouth and horrible bad breath. It also causes, many users report, pounding headaches, and increases your motor activity so you can't keep still. Tweaking is crystal intoxication, so when you're actually under the influence of the drug, lasts between 8 to 12 hours, and that depends on the dose or the purity of the drug. Severe paranoia and hallucinations among some users, rapid body movement or jerking, and meth bugs, the clinical term is parathesias, which is actually caused by an imbalance in your sensory neurons, so people actually feel like bugs are crawling under their skin. And it also increases motor activity and people performing repetitive acts. So those are all the benefits. Some of the side effects include sexual dysfunction. Now, it's interesting that the person who was cited in, the 50s, who reported that when he used Crystal, he felt like his dick was longer. That's actually not most people's experiences. Crystal dick actually refers to erectile dysfunction in men, where it's like a baby's erection, but shrunken. And that's actually a major concern from a disease prevention perspective, because typically condoms, you just can't either put them on or they slip off. It also leads to impotence, which is the inability to achieve orgasm. That has led to people combining crystal meth and crystal meth with sexual performance-enhancing pharmaceuticals such as Viagra, which lasts 4 hours, or what are billed as the weekenders, Cialis or Levitra, which can actually last up to 36 hours. The withdrawal effect, crashing, includes extreme exhaustion, a sleep disorder. Usually people sleep a lot. Sometimes people will report that they can't sleep at all. In some cases, suicidal ideation, increased generalized anxiety or other kinds of anxiety disorders, including agoraphobia, can also lead to what is called crash avoidance. So if you start to experience the symptoms of withdrawal, you might actually choose to continue to use the drug. And crashing may also involve using sleeping pills or other opiates to alleviate the pain from withdrawal. So some of the consequences and additional problems with Crystal is that it actually impairs your cognitive functioning and interferes with short-term memory, notably abstract thinking and judgment, so that a person's ability to perceive risks and consequences while tweaking is diminished. A person may actually engage in high-risk sexual behavior while they're tweaking, which may put them at risk for HIV or syphilis. And mixing drugs when crashing, such as painkillers and sleeping pills, part of the problem is a lot of people, when they start crashing, they'll take a sleeping pill, one of the hypnotics like Ambien or Sonata. And because the crystal is actually still in your system, you may fall asleep briefly, but then you wake up again, and you actually can have a substance-induced amnesia, which is essentially a blackout. Consequences of long-term use include, obviously, the potential for addiction, sexual compulsivity, anorexia, which is a distorted body image, or people become phobic about gaining weight. Lethality can result from kidney failure, dehydration, seizures, and seizures can actually occur after single use, and cardiovascular events such as heart attack or stroke. Meth mouth, which has been described in the literature, is caused by the lack of saliva production. When you use crystal, your ability to produce saliva actually shuts down, and that causes bacteria to grow in your teeth, and that can lead to tooth decay. There's also an anecdotal term that's been coined, which is called crystal-induced osteoporosis. Osteoporosis is where you lose bone density. And it seems to be a problem among people who use crystal. Physical health concerns include correlated risks with increased rates of HIV infection. That's been documented across the country. Increased rates of syphilis. Injectors are also at increased risk of hepatitis C. There's also an increased risk of malnutrition because people stop eating. And there's also, in a number of studies, reported lack of adherence to medications is correlated with crystal methamphetamine use. Drug set and setting is an important concept. It was referred to earlier by Patricia Case, but the dose of the amount of the drug that's taken is relevant to how someone feels, but so is the expectation and the environment in which someone is using.
Once again, because of the limited time available, I won't be able to give you the hours of speeches from this conference. But I want to remind the programmers and the listeners out there that they can soon get audio and video downloads from this conference. They can go to the website of the Harm Reduction Coalition. That's at harmredux.org. CDs are already available, featuring the voices of great folks like a welcome from the mayor of Salt Lake City, Mr. Rocky Anderson, the history of methamphetamine, epidemiology of methamphetamines, medications to enhance treatment of methamphetamine, multi-level approach, working with crystal methamphetamine using men who have sex with men, Native Americans and methamphetamine, and what speed got to do with it, the demonization of a drug, plus dozens more. And I urge you, tune into this data and distribute it to your listening audience. In the wrong hands, at the wrong time, speed can help spread disease and occasionally lead to an overdose death. But those who support drug prohibition ensure that the wrong hands have easy access and that there is never a right time. I hope you're aware that the U.S. Health and Human Services, HHS, first signed up to participate in this conference, and then when Congressman Mark Sauter declared them to be insane for participating, they backed out. But it is the U.S. government policy. In fact, we fought the United Nations trying to keep clean syringes from being made available to addicts. And I'm sorry to say I did not catch the name of this person, but they spoke briefly at the conference. This is the kind of thought I wish to relay to my listeners.
Hepatitis C in particular is 10 times more infectious in a dirty syringe than HIV. And hepatitis B is 100 times more transmittable through a dirty syringe than HIV.
If you go out and try to give away clean syringes to addicts here in the good old USA, you can get yourself in a whole lot of trouble, spend some time behind bars. It just proves that prohibition is a great evil. Do these drug warriors really think that, oh, I can't find a clean syringe, hell, I'm just gonna quit this stuff? What bullshit.
Next up, we have John Gabrowski. He is a professor and the Department of Psychiatry Director at the Substance Abuse Research Center at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston.
And I'm going to Canada tomorrow. This is a long-planned trip. And after this talk, and given what I've heard about Health and Human Services, and given that all my funding is from NIDA, I may be staying in Canada for another 3.5 years. Anyway, I would like to comment on something that Dr. Case said, and it's essentially a question about how we have inadvertent consequences of some of our legislation, and I would ask her whether she would consider that did the 1970 regulations on methamphetamine, or amphetamines generally, the Substance Abuse Control Acts, actually drive the cocaine, the increase in cocaine use. It's an observation I've made over the years, and you can begin to tell how old I am. And that's another point. These are old issues, folks. There ain't nothing new here. I went to graduate school in the 60s, and we had all of these discussions. There are some new things. There are all the HIV issues and a variety of other things. But for a lot of these things, I think you can go look at some of the older, if not scientific literature, at least discussion. And I think that Dr. Case's point made some of that. Now, I would also just like to comment that the amphetamines are useful medications. It isn't necessarily bad that the military uses them. It isn't necessarily bad that people are using modafinil. Modafinil is a good drug. Amphetamine is a good drug. And what you're talking about here are really the risks that are extensions of the therapeutic actions. And that's something to consider. So remember that that's a continuum, and that the risks and deficits are dose-dependent. So those are just a couple of comments. I do have to comment that I've been serving as a consultant to Shire on the issue of stimulant in substance use disorders and ADHD, and the reason is because people are hammering them because they say that their amphetamine product, which is used for ADHD, is causing people to be drug abusers, studying. So I'd like to thank the various people here, and notably my colleagues and collaborators, both locally, nationally, and internationally, and the National Institutes on Drug Abuse, because they have funded much of what we know today. My thoughts, which would be controversial elsewhere, are: do we need systematic search for therapeutic solutions, or is this a war? I think my opinions are pretty obvious. There are some among you who would suggest that we not use medications for treating drug dependence, and I would argue with you, but not to the death, because I'm not that kind of person. Can a medication be a primary therapy? There are those of you who do behavior therapies of one form or another, and you say that's the only way to go, and I would suggest to you, for most people, some combination of the two would be useful, and that for some people, a medication would do just fine, and for others, a behavior therapy would do just fine. I would suggest that some of the things I'm going to talk about, and I'm probably going to run over and be in trouble, but I'm going to talk about giving amphetamines for stimulant dependence, and I think the expectations are problematic, as they are with methadone. People give a medication and they expect that the user, the person who's being treated, is going to become beautiful, well-educated, no longer a criminal, a number of other things. The sole function of a medication is to diminish the use of the particular agent. It's sort of like cardiovascular surgery. You know, you don't expect it to make somebody beautiful and well-educated. You expect it to take care of their heart. And the other thing I would suggest is looking broadly. This isn't a question of methamphetamine, though this conference focuses on that. There's much to be learned from other stimulant dependents, from the work that's been done in other countries, and I'm sorry I'm being a bit professorial and other things here, but I think it's really important that we look around the other treatments. There are a lot of commonalities between opioid dependence and possible treatments and amphetamine dependence and possible treatments, notwithstanding the differences that you see in the people who are using them. And then finally, I would suggest that one of the biggest problems I see is why there's such a translational lag. We have some validated therapies, and people seem to keep on doing what they're doing. Now I'll get to, having harped, I'll get on to this. National Institute on Drug Abuse has examined about 42 different drugs for treatment of cocaine dependence. And I'm going to be talking about cocaine dependence, but again, think of the generality of this. There are many commonalities between cocaine and methamphetamine. There's a cocaine vaccine. I think that will have a limited value, and it's certainly not proving to be as useful. And frankly, it scares me a little bit. But then I'm not funded to do that work, you know. So there are a couple of interesting drugs. Our work with dextroamphetamine, ours and the other work of other people with a drug called GBR-12909, both of which are stimulant-like drugs. We've done some work with L-DOPA, carbidopa, which is for treating Parkinson's disease, and we found that when it's, my colleague Dr. Schmitz has found that when it's closely linked with a heavy-duty behavior therapy, we actually get some benefit out of it, though the medication alone is not sufficient. We did a beautiful study with methamphetamine. It was a small study. We were just trying to see if methamphetamine could treat cocaine dependence, and then there was this war on methamphetamine, and the manufacturer of the sustained speed release preparation took it off the market. I have my thoughts as to why that occurred. And then there's modafinil, which was mentioned earlier, which may have abuse liability, but it's actually a pretty useful drug. Methylphenidate is a drug we looked at for treating cocaine dependence, and it's a really good drug, as are the amphetamines, but it turned out to be of limited usefulness in cocaine users because all they noted was that it made them jittery. These are people who get pretty jittery anyway, but it just didn't have enough of that stabilizing effect. Now, we primarily are looking at agonist-like drugs for treatment, and the reason for that, from my perspective, is I would like somebody to be more comfortable, not more uncomfortable. In the case of stimulants, the actual antagonist drugs, whereas you have naltrexone for opioid dependence, the actual antagonist drugs for stimulants are pretty nasty drugs for the most part, and they have some pretty horrendous side effects. There are potential risks in this strategy, as there are in any strategy, but I would suggest that the risks outweigh the benefits. So I'm going to talk a bit about amphetamine administration for stimulant dependence in UK, US. I'm going to show you some preclinical data. I'm going to talk a bit about our data. There have been a lot of studies, some of them abysmal. There was a guy in 1976 who was giving 125 milligrams of dextroamphetamine IV to amphetamine users. That didn't work out really well. But more recently, the studies have been somewhat more realistic. There have been three studies with cocaine dependence, all reasonably successful. And finally, I would like to show, in this vein, I'd like to show you something about from an animal study. Negus and Mello at Harvard, Nancy Mello actually said at a meeting recently that the best treatment for cocaine and amphetamine dependence would be amphetamine by another name, thus sidestepping all the political issues. But this is really interesting, and you'll just bear with me. This is a monkey that's been giving itself cocaine for long periods of time, and they gave the animal dextroamphetamine. Dextroamphetamine has food decreasing properties. We know it causes anorexia or anorectic effects. But within days, food taking went back to normal, and for the full time of the infusions, the animal didn't take any cocaine. That, some of you will appreciate how truly significant that is. I would note that all of our studies are really driven by hardcore clinical trials protocols. We've done a series of studies. I mentioned the methamphetamine study, and what I'm just going to show you here are the differences. Sustained-release methamphetamine reducing cocaine use over a two-month period in a population of users. That was a small trial. In a very large trial, anyway, you'll notice that the people who got placebo continued to have positive benzylecanine, that's a cocaine metabolite, screens, whereas the people who were getting dextroamphetamine sustained release actually had reductions in use. We did another study with a very difficult population, opioid cocaine users, heroin cocaine users, giving them methadone and dextroamphetamine. And here again, we simply found, well, methadone did what it was supposed to do, but we found that the higher dose of dextroamphetamine suppressed or greatly reduced cocaine taking. And now I'm talking about cocaine. Well, it seems to me you've got an even clearer case for replacement of amphetamine for amphetamine. We did another study because people have complained, well, are you going to keep people on amphetamine for the rest of their lives the way we might do with opioids? I prefer not to, but we did do a sequential study where we gave amphetamine and then we gave three other drugs, and for the three other drugs, fluoxetine, that's Prozac, L-DOPA, and placebo itself, everything else went up when we switched, and the amphetamine users still started going down gradually. These were small dose studies because of initial concerns. Safety, while in fact it does have cardiovascular effects, stimulants do, within the therapeutic dose range, those are not pronounced. This is the full course of a study. There's no difference in heart rate, diastolic or systolic pressure. So what you're talking about when you're talking about abuse is way outside the therapeutic range. In fact, these are reasonably safe drugs. I will move on here and just note that we had really excellent compliance. These folks, there was one case where somebody who was receiving an amphetamine tablet for their treatment, didn't give it to a spouse. The spouse took it to find out if it was different from what she was getting, and it was. Now, in summary, in the UK, they've done a series of essentially community clinic type retrospective studies. In Australia, they've done a series of controlled studies, again, in community clinics. What we've done here in the U.S. in our very relatively few studies, because it was difficult to get this work going. I was called a cowboy because I wanted to give amphetamine to cocaine users. And that, even though I live in Texas, I was born in Minnesota, and that was really painful. But what you have here is world data sets, similar doses, different clinical settings, somewhat different cultural groups. Granted, these are dominantly Western societies, but very different methods, and yet they all end up with the same result, which is some benefit, or if you will, harm reduction from giving amphetamine to amphetamine or cocaine users for the reduction of that. Now, where are we going to go? I think that deamphetamine may not be the answer. It happens to look good in our data and other people's data, but there are real social problems with that. And there is years of demonization, but it does produce a strategy and a model. I think NIDA is really now looking at agonist-like drugs, drugs like this. There are some new things coming through that may be beneficial. The whole thing is regimen-dependent. There's relatively low abuse liability when it's in a good treatment setting, just as there is with methadone. There are some interesting new drugs coming up that I think we can expect to see. We need some new protocols. Mendelsohn and Gant Galloway in San Francisco are looking, essentially redoing our study with methamphetamine users in San Francisco, and I think they'll probably be rather successful. Critical problem is going to be clinicians who have been essentially brainwashed for the last 30 years about how bad these drugs are. By the way, if you talk to older clinicians, there's some recognition that these aren't such bad drugs, but they're fairly silent. They do recall good times. And I think most critical, and the thing that you can all do together, and I think in conjunction with people like those at NIDA, is educating the public and depoliticize the issue and destigmatize the issue, because that's, I think, where we're running into all the impediments of even implementing treatments that might be effective. So I thank you very much.
Today I want to talk to you all about Operation Wildfire. A few weeks ago, the ONDCP was hauled up before Congress and grilled about why it used its $11 billion budget mostly to arrest pot smokers while meth has spread like wildfire. And yesterday, the U.S. Attorney General and DEA Administrator Karen Tandy presented the results of Operation Wildfire, touted as an undercover nationwide crackdown against all levels of meth and a huge success. This unprecedented law enforcement effort has resulted in the arrest of 427 individuals. My friend Steve Heath in Clearwater, Florida, posted this breakdown of the numbers on the Internet. Stephen Heath, at an average of 2 individuals per city, I think they may have missed a few levels. DOJ said the streamlined efforts of the federal, state, and local law enforcement resulted in the seizure of 209 pounds of meth, 201,035 tablets of pseudoephedrine, 158 kilograms of pseudoephedrine powder, and 224,860 tablets of ephedrine. 56 clandestine laboratories were seized, 30 endangered children were removed from their meth environments. Finally, 28 vehicles and 123 weapons were seized during the raid, and 96 search warrants were executed. Following the huge multi-agency effort, the score is 1 whole pound per city, 1,000 tablets of Sudafed per city, that's less than 20 bottles of 60 count each, and 1.5 pounds of powder per city and ephedrine, about 20 small plastic bottles, available in most convenience stores in America. Barely one lab seized for 4 cities, a bit more than one weapon per raid. Oh, almost forgot. Created at least 427 new job openings in the illegal drug distribution market. And Stephen Heath is absolutely correct. This isn't even a drop in the bucket. The DEA is simply pretending to do something, while in reality, nothing is being done. Do you reckon they spent as much on this operation, which appears to have been thrown together in less than a month, as they did on their 18-month international undercover operation to arrest Mark Emery for openly selling marijuana seeds on the Internet? This is Loretta Nall reporting for the U.S. Marijuana Party from Alabama. Until next time, y'all be safe and stay out of jail.
I want to thank the folks in Northampton and Houston and Galveston for listening to today's Century of Lies. Next week, our guest will be Judge James P. Gray, the author of Why the Drug War Has Failed and What We Can Do About It. Be sure to tune into this week's Cultural Baggage, our guest, Tommy Chong. In closing, there is no justice, no truth, no scientific fact, no medical data. There is no reason whatsoever for the drug war to continue for another second. Please do your part to help end this abomination. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. We've been duped. Prohibido istac ivalesco. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.